From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Santa Clara.
Santa Cruz.
Union City.
Hayward.
San Francisco.
I'm from Fremont.
Yo, I'm San Jose, just downtown.
Coming up, we'll take a deep dive into the controversial mining technique of fracking in California.
The smells could be so bad that it could actually hurt you. Literally, if you were to be closer, you would feel headaches, you would feel dizzy, nauseous.
Then we'll head to the wine aisle of Trader Joe's to see how two-buck chuck stays so cheap, even if it's now two-and-a-half-buck chuck.
I buy a two-buck chuck because it's basically box wine in a bottle.
And we'll uncover the history of one family's mysterious bottle of wine.
What's your best guess as to what this might be worth?
Well, it's somewhere between $500 and $1,000.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. This week, we're taking on the debate over fracking, the controversial process for extracting oil and natural gas trapped underground. And for that, we're heading to Kern County at the southern end of the Central Valley. Kern County is home to a lot of the oil production and fracking in California. The largest oil fields lie in the foothills on the western edge of the valley where the salty groundwater makes it difficult for crops to grow. Farming does thrive in the flat middle of the valley where the groundwater's good. This is how farmer Tom France explains it.
That's just the way it is, and it's always been that way. And the oil doesn't seem to be where there's good groundwater.
But that might be about to change now that oil resources have been discovered deep beneath the region's farmland in the Monterey Shale. Reporter Mark Hertzgard has been following this story, and he joins me in studio. I asked him to give us a snapshot of the history of fracking in California.
Well, in California, it's fracking for oil, not natural gas. That's important. In Pennsylvania and in North Dakota, it's been about natural gas. California, it's oil. And oil has been a big part of our economy for over 100 years. California, despite its green reputation, has been one of the world's leading oil producers since the 1890s. Fracking, on the other hand, has been pretty limited in that period. The first incidents of fracking go back into the 50s, but it's been quite limited. And it's been of a very specific type, vertical fracking, which is to say that the existing oil wells just get punched deeper down into the earth in order to break the rock beneath and access oil that's further down. Now, the potential for fracking going forward is going to be much more horizontal drilling. And that's because of the bizarre, complex geology of California. Of course, we're known as the earthquake state. And because of that, much more complicated to frack here. You've got to horizontally do it because, as one of our sources, Dan Jacobson at the nonprofit group Environment California, he said, you know, California's geology is a lot like a big bowl of nachos. And the geology of North Dakota is like a plate of lasagna. It's very layered, it's very even, it's very straight. And so when you punch vertically down, it's pretty simple, technologically, relatively simple. Whereas in California, because of the nachos factor, you kind of go down and off to the side and then around through all, you've got to thread your well through the dips and the folds of our underground geology. So much, much tougher to frack here in California.
And it's the Monterey Shale that has people both excited and fearful of this sort of vast amount of potential oil that's there. But there's new research about that that may really be a game changer.
Game changer indeed. The Monterey Shale is a deposit that stretches across much of the southern part of the Central Valley from Bakersfield northwest up to the Monterey coast. And originally, the federal government was saying that there could be as much as 15 billion barrels of oil under there. They revised that to 13.7 billion, but still an enormous amount. Now, on May 20th, the game change in development was that the Energy Information Agency of the federal government slashed their estimate of the recoverable oil in the Monterey Shale by 96%. They're now saying 600 million barrels. Not 13 billion, but 600 million barrels. That's pretty small by California standards.
And so there's the environmental concerns, there's the economic potential, and then there's the politics of this. I think most people think that our governor, Governor Jerry Brown, is an environmentalist and really a leader in terms of global warming, et cetera. So what are the politics around fracking in California?
Well, you've put your finger on it. It's California is known around the world as an environmental trendsetter. And that's largely because of what Jerry Brown did when he was governor the first time in the 1970s, when he rejected nuclear power, championed solar and wind power, set in motion the changes that have allowed us to keep our electricity consumption flat, even as our economy has tripled and our population has doubled. You know, so Jerry Brown in California, if you talk to people overseas, that is kind of the gold standard of environmental policy and consciousness, frankly. So it's a big question. Does Jerry Brown allow fracking in California? Many environmentalists say you cannot frack California if you are serious about being a climate change champion, which Governor Brown has said over and over again that that's what he wants to be. He's gone to China on behalf of the Obama administration to try and cut deals around climate concerns. So that's a big, big part of the politics here. On the other hand, so he's got to look at the environmental side of this. But of course, the other side of the politics is that oil companies have been politically powerful in this state again for almost 100 years since the first oil strikes here. So it's a major, I think, conundrum for Governor Brown.
Mark Hertzgard is an environmental reporter, and now we're going to go ahead and hear the first of your two stories on fracking in California.
In the farming town of Shafter, kids are playing outside Sequoia Elementary School. On the other side of the playground is an organic community garden. Shafter residents Rodrigo Romo and Annabelle Marquez are picking vegetables.
We're just cutting a little zucchini because the season is coming to pick them.
It's time to take them out. We're using them to make food to cook.
Romo says many people in Shafter are farm workers who know how to grow vegetables, but they don't have their own yards to make a garden. Marquez says having this space has been great, but they were surprised and unhappy when oil wells were drilled barely 100 yards away.
We want to eat healthy, and the contamination gets closer. How can we advise our children on what healthy eating is if the contamination is here? It is very sad.
Es triste, muy triste.
Standing in this garden, I can see three oil wells. Each of them has been fracked. Juan Flores works with the Center for Race, Poverty, and the Environment, a national environmental justice organization.
Last year when we had the grand opening of the garden, that's when we noticed that there was some drilling going on, and we started wondering, well, what's going on? The smells could be so bad that it could actually hurt you. Literally, if you were to be close there, you would feel headaches, you would feel dizzy, nauseous. So last year, that's when we got all into getting to know more about fracking and getting our community members educated.
Rodrigo Romo believes people in the community, including his own daughter, have gotten sick since the wells were drilled. Similar complaints have come from people near fracking operations in other parts of the United States. A citizens group in Pennsylvania has documented 27 cases of residents complaining of breathing problems, skin rashes, nosebleeds, and headaches. A Texas family sued an oil company for poisoning their water supply and livestock. And in April, a jury awarded that family $2.9 million in damages. I head out to the western part of Kern County, where most of California's oil production and fracking has taken place. So we're on Highway 33 in western Kern County here. There's scrub. It's very dry here. It's desert. And it's called the Petroleum Highway for good reason, because all up and down this strip of highway, pretty much as far as you can see, are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of oil wells. A second large oil field, this one in the city of Bakersfield, looks like an anthill that's been kicked over. It covers more than 10,000 acres, and it's densely packed with pump jacks, the devices that sit atop oil wells and are nicknamed nodding donkeys for the way their snouts bob up and down, relentlessly sucking oil from below.
We are looking at Kern River Oil Field.
Kern County native Nick Ortiz works for a trade group called the Western States Petroleum Association. He says oil was discovered here in the 1890s.
2007, it produced its 2 billionth barrel of oil. California has a rich oil history, something that in Kern County we're rather proud of. California is the third largest oil producing state in the nation, behind Texas and North Dakota.
Part of that status is due to fracking. Ortiz says hydraulic fracturing is a tool that's been used in California for decades and is well understood, as it has been practiced so far. But how fracking might be used in the future, that's another question.
When it comes to, you know, the Monterey, I think everyone sees the Monterey, again, as a great economic opportunity and an opportunity to help fill the energy needs of Californians and to continue to drive California's economy. Again, it's an open question whether or not hydraulic fracturing is going to be the thing that unlocks the Monterey Shale and allows large-scale production.
The industry says California has to keep exploring for oil.
We most definitely need petroleum in order to ensure that our economy thrives. And I think, you know, Kern County is a great microcosm of that. When you look at our industries here, you know, you have petroleum production, but you also have agriculture. You can't plow a field without diesel. You can't bring product to market without a truck.
Tom France is a fourth-generation Kern County farmer, born and raised on this farm near Shafter. He props a ladder against the side of his barn and climbs up to the roof.
This is my perch up here to see, basically, to see what's around me, because the trees kind of block my view when I'm on the ground. But I can see the Tembler Range to the west and south, and the Tehachapis to the south and east, and the Sierras directly east.
The mountains form a kind of bowl here, trapping pollutants.
It's a fairly good day today as far as air quality goes. It's a little hazy, but it's not that ugly grayish-brown haze we have so much of the time as a place with the worst air quality in the nation.
In a study by the American Lung Association, Kern County topped most of the lists of the most polluted counties in the United States. When it comes to pollution in the Central Valley, there are lots of culprits. Pesticides and trucks connected to farming, but also leakage of benzene and methane from oil production. France walks out to the orchards to prune almond trees, which he started growing here in 1983. Like a lot of farmers, France owns this land, but not the mineral rights beneath it. The people who do own those rights can lease them to oil companies.
The fracking has started 10 years ago in this agricultural area where we're standing, just a mile or two from here.
Now, he says, wells have been fracked in every direction around him. To France, in places where agriculture thrives, oil and water don't mix.
They're taking it out of the water cycle. When I water my trees, there's trans evaporation of that water out of these leaves, but that water goes into the air basically as steam and forms clouds somewhere and drops it again on the earth. When they use it for fracking, they've destroyed it forever because they dispose of it then back 5,000 feet under the ground where it just stays forever. So I don't like that one bit.
Fracking a single well can require 2 to 8 million gallons of water. Opponents question this scale of water use, especially in the middle of California's historic drought. France, though, is most concerned about the potential contamination of groundwater. He's worried about cement casings on underground pipes failing and leaking oil and chemicals. He's worried about spills above ground, too. In 2012, he videotaped a subsidiary of Occidental Petroleum illegally dumping black liquid into an open pit a few feet from trees. The dumping led to a fine of $60,000.
This is an almond in an immature stage. All right, the inside of this almond, just bite it open there. Right now, that almond is a jelly. See that liquid in there? It's 100% water right now. That turns into a solid nut or seed in another month or so. All right, everything in this almond is dependent on what's in the soil and what's in the water that grows these trees. And so first time something shows up in our almonds, a little chemical, like a little benzene or something, a little trace, no one's going to buy almonds from here anymore. We grow 2 billion pounds of almonds in a year right now. So you know, it's like a $50 billion industry as far as the economy goes in here in the valley. And fracking has a potential to wipe that out.
I bring up these health and safety concerns to Nick Ortiz of the Western States Petroleum Association. He refers to a bill passed in Sacramento last year, Senate Bill 4. SB 4 requires oil companies to register their fracking operations with the state and disclose them to nearby residents. It also requires the state to conduct a study of fracking's implications for public health, safety, and the environment, including global warming.
Californians, I think, can be assured, regardless of where they are in California, that under the rules that govern us today and all of the pieces of SB 4 that are yet to be implemented, Californians will be well protected by the most comprehensive set of regulations in the nation.
Nevertheless, Ortiz acknowledges that the Western States Petroleum Association did not support the legislature's passage of SB 4 last year. Back at the community garden in Shafter, residents like Rosario Garcia believe their questions aren't being answered and that fracking in their community is harmful.
The climate's a little bad because they're excavating and putting in tons of chemicals.
Garcia says he's had great difficulties breathing for 2 years after contracting valley fever. It's a disease caused by certain fungi in the soil getting stirred up by things like farming, construction, and oil drilling. Garcia says two of his best friends died from it.
This illness, it comes from some time ago, and we are accelerating it because of the fracking.
My name is Miguel Garcia, and I am 9 years old, and I am in third grade.
Garcia's son Miguel has been diagnosed with asthma, and Miguel's younger brother is developing breathing problems too.
When I have asthma, my chest hurts, I have headaches, and it feels like if my heart was hurting. But it's actually my chest. And then I feel like if I was going to die, I have to not play around with dirt, not be outside in the cold, and stay healthy. I feel mad because I can't play outside with my friends.
Rosario Garcia points at his friends working in the garden.
¿Quién sabe, no?
The truth is, a lot of people continue to be sick. Here you see three, but if you go to the town, you see a lot from the same thing.
Fellow gardener Annabel Marquez says that people are scared and that their fear is understandable. She says there's a basic first step they all need to take.
It is just that we need to educate ourselves and learn more to be able to defend ourselves.
Oil and farming are both central to California's economy, and both need water. That old saying that oil and water don't mix? Now, fracking is putting that notion to the test. In Kern County, I'm Mark Hertzgard for Cross Currents.
Thanks to the Invoking the Pause Foundation for supporting our series on fracking in California. Tomorrow we'll explore the challenges facing Governor Jerry Brown, balancing energy, environmental, and economic interests in the fracking debate.
I think he wants to meet the state's climate goals on reducing greenhouse gases. He really wants to meet them. He's committed. And yet he's had a hard time saying no to the oil companies the last couple years.
That's tomorrow when our series on fracking in California continues. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Last year, for the first time, Americans surpassed the French as the number one consumers of wine in the world. Wine is certainly more accessible and cheaper than ever. And you can't talk about cheap wine without talking about Charles Shaw, famously known as Two Buck Chuck. Two Buck Chuck is now $2.49 Chuck here in the Bay Area, but it's still the standard bearer of cheap wine. In this story from our archives, RTM's Kunahoffs takes a look at how wine got so cheap.
It's Saturday evening, and I'm in one of the Trader Joe's stores in San Francisco. Right in the center of the wine section, there is Charles Shaw. It has the biggest space and the most prominent position. You can see Sauvignon Blanc, Merlot, Chardonnay, Pinot Grigio. Big sign above the bottles says Charles Shaw, still only $1.99 after all these years. Charles Shaw wines are made by the Bronco Wine Company based in Ceres, California, near Modesto. The brand was born just over a decade ago, when Bronco and other producers found themselves harvesting too many grapes. One of the company's founders, Fred Franzia, came up with the idea to undercut the competition. He'd make a $2 bottle, according to San Francisco Chronicle wine editor John Bonnet.
He was able to kind of go in, name his price, and come up with this ridiculously inexpensive wine. And then over time, he's had to figure out how to keep supplying it, not the least of which is, frankly, planting his own vineyards.
Now, Bronco owns a lot of land in California, more than 40,000 acres of vineyards, mostly in the San Joaquin Valley. And Charles Shaw wine is just one of more than 90 different Bronco brands, most of which sell for less than $10 a bottle. But economies have changed, and after 10 years and 600 million bottles, how is Two Buck Chuck still just $2? I went to Bronco's bottling facility to find out. Charles Shaw wine is produced here in Napa at an average speed of 245 bottles per minute. Fred Franzia's son, Joe, runs this recently built factory. He gave me a tour and says he's really proud of how it's changing the industry.
We're one of the first to pioneer a lightweight glass.
That's big. Here's why. A typical case of wine weighs about 36 pounds. A case of lightweight bottles weighs 30, which means Bronco can ship more at a time.
So basically one in every five trucks is paying for itself, reducing the carbon footprint.
Franzia says it's a win-win, good for the environment and for the profit margin.
That is really starting to become the standard of the industry because the freight, the fuel's going up. And when you're dealing with products, wine products under $10 a bottle, you're very sensitive to gas prices affecting your bottom line.
Another example is cork.
There's a lot of wineries that are cutting costs by just using a composite cork or a plastic cork.
Bronco prefers not to use plastic cork for any of its wines. Some have screw caps, known in the industry as Stelvin closures. But for Charles Shaw, Bronco uses one of the cheapest forms of natural cork. Franzia says it's a mold of small pieces with a real cork veneer at the bottom.
We believe cork to be the primary closure method for wine, so we want to maintain the high quality of the cork with a natural tip as a barrier between the composite and the wine itself.
The Chronicle's John Bonnet says such production details are important to understand, especially when it comes to cheap wine.
Quite honestly, the bigger part of the cost is glass, cork, and distribution. It's one of the reasons that anywhere outside California, Two Buck Chuck is actually $3.
$3 Chuck.
Simply, the cost of shipping it anywhere out of state becomes high enough that you just can't support it. In terms of the wine is not terribly expensive. I would say it's probably maybe 30 or 40% of the cost, if that.
That means the actual wine inside a bottle of Charles Shaw has a retail value of about 75 cents.
The grapes are very cheap. They're almost entirely grown in the San Joaquin.
California's Central Valley, where land is cheaper than in Napa or Sonoma. And
Fred Franzia, who runs Bronco, is an absolute master of leveraging the bulk wine system to kind of pick up bulk wine where it's available.
Which means a bottle of Two Buck Chuck could come from almost anywhere.
This was sort of the genius of it, is they made it feel like it was a real bottle of wine. They made it look like it was a real bottle of wine. And what was in it was sort of incidental. And honestly, no one has much complained.
Joe Franzia says that's because it tastes good.
Yeah, you don't sell on average 5.5-6 million cases a year for 10 years if you're selling product that people didn't enjoy.
And then there is the labor itself.
In order to do farming for grapes that are that cheap, you need to find labor that's really as cheap as you can get.
Again, San Francisco Chronicle wine editor John Bonnet.
It's not a surprise that most vineyard work in California is done by migrant workers.
So, production, quality, land, labor. The other thing determining the cost of wine in California is prestige.
Thank you for calling San Francisco Wine Trading Company. How can I help you?
I joined wine consultant Fred Daniels in the aisles of the San Francisco Wine Trading Company. I asked him to explain the difference between two bottles of Pinot Noir. One $12, the other $46.
For something like Turkey, it could be a wine that is very well made, but it's made from Monterey County, so the vineyards don't have that prestige.
While the $46 bottle comes from the Russian River Valley.
The wines there typically run in this price range. If I go to Russian River and buy grapes from that area, the wines automatically would be priced in this price range.
None of that applies to brands like Charles Shaw. The label only says the wine comes from California. Which is one reason why critics like John Bonnet say that it almost doesn't make sense to discuss the quality of such lower shelf bottles that cost less than $15.
You know, probably a good chunk of what you're tasting in there could be grape concentrate, could be sugar, sort of residual flavor from oak products. Not barrels necessarily, but chips or sawdust or whatever that gives this kind of oak flavor. And so part of what you're doing when you're making wine at that level is simply to come up with something that tastes okay.
And for millions of wine drinkers, that's good enough. For CrossCurrents, I'm Artem Skonohas.
That story first aired in May of 2012. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. We just heard about the real cost of a bottle of cheap wine. Now to a very different bottle of wine, an important bottle that has been in reporter Reese Ehrlich's family since he can remember. Ehrlich went on a journey to get to the bottom of the bottle and uncork the mystery of his family's wine.
My mom and dad kept their wine in the shower. Not the shower they showered in. It was an old lime green tiled shower they had converted into a wine cellar. Sort of. Anyway, for years they had kept a 2/5 of a gallon Sebastiani Barbera wine in the shower. It was so old, vintners don't even make that size bottle anymore. I had no idea what the wine was or how much it might be worth. It wasn't listed on the internet, and wine collectors had never heard of it. So I decided to dig deeper into the history of my mystery magnum. I started here at the Sebastiani Winery in the city of Sonoma. Winemaker Mark Lyon says 50 years ago, his winery didn't use small oak barrels. They aged Barbera in huge redwood vats, which are considered museum pieces today because they are never used.
In these 4,000-gallon tanks is how they were storing their finer reds over a couple of years to help them soften and mellow out their reds. Back then, that was the style of aging Barbera.
And that explains mystery number one, why there's no vintage year on my magnum. In those days, Sebastiani and most other California vintners blended their wines to taste the same each year, just like hard liquor. So they aged the wine in huge vats and blended different vintages. Lyon describes Barbera, which originally came from northern Italy, as a full-bodied wine, kind of like Zinfandel.
I think it has some plummy, a little bit of anise spiciness to the aroma. Really nice blackberry and raspberry tones.
I wouldn't know. I never drank any. Even more to the point, nobody currently working at Sebastiani had ever heard of my particular magnum of Barbera. So, on to mystery number two. Who made this stuff? I track down Sam Sebastiani, now 73 years old, who is grandson of the company founder. He no longer works for Sebastiani, but we met at the winery so he could taste my Barbera. He says the Mystery Magnum was a special bottling for a Sacramento restaurant done in the mid-1960s. Sebastiani says the restaurant promised to buy 100 cases of Magnums over 2 years.
My recollection is that we did 125 cases. And I think in reality they bought 7 or 8 total. So we ended up with the rest of them, and we put them on the market because we couldn't drink quite that much ourselves.
Mystery number two solved. I couldn't find the wine listed anywhere because it was a limited special bottling.
So it was unique, and we'll see how unique the wine is when we open it.
So now what we in public radio call the antique roadshow moment.
Right.
What's your best guess as to what this might be worth?
Well, it's somewhere between $500 and $1,000.
Wow, I'm supposed to say. Now on to mystery number three. Why had almost a third of the wine disappeared from the bottle? Turns out, when a wine is stored for many decades, the cork can dry out and small amounts of wine drip out over time. Oxygen accumulates in the bottleneck. Narcy David says that's very bad for the wine. I dragged the man famed as a restaurateur and wine aficionado here to the tasting room to offer a dispassionate assessment of my Barbera.
I know that this wine has a lot of emotional value to you, but there's so much airspace in there. I don't expect this to be an exciting wine. There is certainly a chance that it'll still be a good drinkable wine.
So now for the moment of truth. Mark Lyon uses a knife to cut the old metal foil at the top of the bottle.
Like performing surgery. We have some extra wine glasses.
Now we each say a little prayer to the god Bacchus, right? Whoa, got beautiful color.
Yeah,
look at that.
Sam Sebastiani takes the first sip and offers advice to Narcy David.
He's going to be surprised how good it is.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
Mark, your opinion?
Yeah, I'm surprised how well it tastes.
I was half expecting vinegar or something. Well, thank you all, gentlemen. This is really a very pleasant surprise. If we had a antiques wine show, this would be the moment.
It just went back up to $1,000 a bottle.
The wine was surprisingly good, as my family learned when I brought the rest of the bottle home. I learned a lot from my wine journey. The Barbera grape maintains a niche appeal among American wine enthusiasts. Sebastiani sells it at the winery tasting room. Sam Sebastiani plans to bottle some Barbera under his La Chartosa brand. As for me, I found a new appreciation for a full-bodied, plummy wine with hints of blackberries. But all things considered, I'd rather have the $1,000. For Cross Currents, I'm Reese Ehrlich in Sonoma.
And with that, we'll raise our glasses to you. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KLW News. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Mack, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, Liza Veal, Melanie Young, and Rachel Wong. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer today is Sandhya Dirks. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And because of your support, we can proudly say we are locally grown, handcrafted, listener-supported public radio. The Pangea Football Club sounds like it's a soccer team, but it's actually the San Francisco band that you're hearing right now. Their goal, get it, is to get people around the world to dance to one festive heartbeat. You can dance to that heartbeat twice this week in San Francisco's Mission District at El Valenciano on Thursday and then at the Revolution Cafe on Friday. Both shows start at 9 p.m. All of that information, along with more local stories and more local music, is at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.